The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
And on top of that, a good portion of my own personal wealth and portfolio. It has made gains here as of this morning that I'd never had, maybe in some total of everything for the 38 years or 39 years, whatever I've been doing this. And yet my heart is troubled. And I really don't enjoy it. Probably good news. That means that my walk with my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ over there is improving. And I'm not the total horrible sinner that I might have once been. Doesn't make me any better than anybody, but at least I'm walking in the right direction.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. The voice you just heard is my good friend and your good friend, Peter Grandage from PeterGrandage.com. He's known as the former Wall Street whiz kid. Without even a high school diploma, he became half famous on Wall Street, made and lost millions more than once. In his book, Confessions of a Former Wall Street Whiz Kid, Peter tells his incredible journey and how his Catholic faith led to true Christian conversion. He provides guidance on matters of finance through Peter Grandage & Company, and you can find out more at petergrandage.com or just listen right here because Peter's here on a regular basis. Peter, my friend, so good to hear you.
Well, thank you. I was taken back. That's one of my videos that I make to my followers, and it was an emotional one that... And then to hear it on Relevant Radio. So in a way, I'm appreciative because it's been such an impact on my life and what's happening. So I thank everyone for playing it because it's been a very tough time. I never thought, I'm entering 39th year doing this, that things would go so good from an advisory point and have so much wealth and not enjoy it at all because of the suffering and the pain that's going on that has, you know, led to this. So it's been a quite challenge. You think you've seen it all, Ed, when you've been at it 38 years, but it's just, you know, just can't believe it. It's a very, very tough time for, I think, anybody with a conscience. I would hope they would feel as I do, that I would give all the gains back if I could turn back the time and not have what we're witnessing and seeing on live on TV every night.
Well, you know, this is something, it's not as though you're some sort of speculator on this point, Peter. You've been talking about this for, I mean, almost as long as I've known you, is that people need to get out from debt, they need to get out from some of these equities, they need to start looking at, you know, the type of basic safe investments because of the storms that are coming. And I know that that's not a popular message. You and I talk about this a lot, and we talk about the fact that it's not a popular message either because pessimism doesn't sell. It may be entirely accurate, however, and what you talk about today is basically the fruition of a strategy that is, it's certainly paying off, and we never want to see the circumstances like this that create those financial conditions. But again, this is not like something that you were betting on somebody's misery. You just saw some of these storms coming. And I think people who have maybe dismissed you as a little bit of a, you know, end is near banner carrier on the corner, maybe they should be rethinking their assessment of you at this point in time.
Well, I appreciate that, and I really do, because I know how much you mean it personally. But, you know, it goes back to something that was told to me a long time ago. I was told that when it came on Wall Street, there's only two types of advisors, those who say what they think or those who say what they think people want to hear and it sells. And I've always been in the former group, at least for most of my career. And then because of everything that's happened in my life that you and Drew are kind enough and Relevant Radio have shared over the years, and I've been able to talk about it, and people read in the book, you know, making and losing millions, once being a legend in my own mind, turning the Ten Commandments into the Ten Suggestions, all the things that sinners do, you know, I'm among them.
Me too.
But these last few years especially, you know, the good Lord has put on my heart, as you know, I don't want to begin to think that what self-serving, some sort of profit. But
right.
Certainly things that were not being said, and certainly, as you said, let me just tell you, for everybody that walked in the door because I said it, nine walked out the door. Okay, so right. it wasn't a business ploy. If it was, it was the poorest one to take. but things that we have spoken about, even in most recent times, like last year, when we started to talk about, you know, it's time to get we're in such a big financial bubble. Everything's priced for perfection. The lack of professional real experience out there. You know, you've heard me talk about 2/3 of financial advisors were only in the business since the last financial crisis. And that if anything comes along out of the ordinary, we had a lot of negative circumstances. We had a country that was broke. We had political and social and economic division, nothing as bad as perhaps other than during the Civil War. We had all this lack of experience, and we've had, realistically, a financial bubble that was pushed up by money being spent that we don't have, and, you know, that's the whole thing about debt. And so when you would sit with people and saying, listen, I think you need to take a step back, I think you need to pay down debt if you can and all. Are you kidding me? The guy just down the street said he's got this black box and it says, and for a while it worked because, you know, things were, you know, just, that's what happens in bubbles. And now if you look at the very things that 6 or 9 months ago, which were the biggest stories and people talking about, from Bitcoins to Cathie Wood and all these people talking about all these stocks trading at, you know, 800 times earnings and all this stuff that were going to keep going up. That's where the biggest damage is, and unfortunately, that's where you find most of the public suffering from. It's usually not the big professional financial advising group. It's usually the public that gets left holding a bag, and I don't think it's over. I wish I liked to say that the worst is behind us. There may be some traumatic relief rallies in this, but this is a dramatic change socially, politically, and economically now, and we have things that just can't turn around again on a dime. So unfortunately, I wish I could bear good news, but I think I'm still bad news Pete.
Well, and look, I mean, I think that part of the issue here is that there's just so much bad news, and so much of it is market-based. I mean, we could talk about the jobs report. I don't think that there's anything terribly interesting in the jobs report, but we can certainly talk about it. Maybe just the fact that wages were flat, even though you're adding a bunch of jobs, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But I think what's much more interesting in terms of what you're talking about in terms of investments is what's happening in the global markets because of all the sanctions that are being applied to Russia right now. And there's going to be a tremendous disruption in these markets while the what are called the knock-on effects of all these sanctions play out. And knock-on effects just means secondary and tertiary. It's the ripples that go out from these sanctions. Nobody's really quite sure how that's going to work out because the sanctions that are being applied to Russia are so massive and so unprecedented that there's really no model for this. And that's another reason to be careful about where your money's going. And I mean, you've been telling people now recently to, you know, get out of general equities. You were telling, I mean, when I say recently, I mean, you know, last year you were telling people to do that and, you know, get into precious metals and warning about Bitcoin, which is apparently going to come into play here as a sort of a sanctions avoidance tool for Russian businesses and oligarchs. I mean, this is tremendously disruptive. Nobody can really predict what's going to happen here. And that's another good reason to just play it safe.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? Like you just said, what always was, for as long as I can remember, even when there were geopolitical things happening, that first Friday of the month, boy, we would tune to what happens in the employment report and the news of it impacts the markets, and that's what we would spend most of the day talking about. And it was at best an afterthought today. COVID it disappeared like the flu. I mean, you know, it's something that we were just a couple weeks ago so enthralled about and worried about. Has gone. But I think one of the things that happened, Ed, I don't know if I had a chance to talk to you personally about this, but one of the things that really spooked me before this Russian thing, which I thought was very worrisome, but now, of course, this is towering past that, is what happened in Canada, that a Western so-called country leader could decide to just take away and say, you can't have this. We're not going to allow you to have your own money or access to your own money. Or if you do this, we're not going to allow you to earn an income, and we're going to take away your licenses and all that. What happened in Canada over what I would say is a very mild protest. I don't think there was anything where people, unlike the protests that took back here in 2020 throughout the United States, that was very, very worrisome to me. And something that I think you need to put in the back of your head, because no matter what happens here, even if it's a terrible thing to say, but even if somehow Putin is gone tomorrow and the Russian thing is put on a halt and it doesn't go to where it's most likely to head at this point in time, the damages that were already done, the irreversible situations in that, the tremendous impact on food, the availability of food, energy, all those things are all going to play into something that was already taken off anyway, and that's inflation. And once the inflation is out of the bottle, the genie's out of the bottle, unless you do what something like Volcker did, basically to shove it back in, there's no easy task. No matter what the Fed is telling you, and by the way, they've been so wrong on it in their predictions, but no matter what they say about it, is this situation that's happened has increased that by 10 to 20 fold. And that'll be, even if tomorrow the war is for some reason, hopefully God willing, ended or ceases or lessens or whatever, that part of the equation now has been pumped up to something that I think is irreversible and going to be extremely painful in a country, and I always go back to this, Ed, where Peter has been running with Paul and they tapped out. We're at $30+ trillion. We have a $3 trillion budget deficit, and this is only going to add to it. And we have a Fed that's supposed to raise interest rates to lower inflation, and yet if we raise interest rates to a point, we may not be able to make our interest payments on the debt. So there's a whole series of things now that I think this situation, no matter even if it ended tomorrow, has only accelerated to the worst that side of things.
Well, and that's not even counting if the situation, the current acute situation in Ukraine turns worse. I mean, one of the things that we saw today, and we were speaking in previous hour with Valentina Pasvyukova about, is the seizure of the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia, right? I mean, that's something that's never happened before. We've never had a military attack a nuclear power complex, shelling it using artillery. And that, I mean, that certainly, I think, is something that has greatly changed the calculus in people's minds about what's going to happen in the future. And that's going to be expressed economically. It always is. I mean, it may not be the first thing that you think of, but it's, economics is, at least in large part, the culture of working with risks, with potential risks in the future. And this is now a completely novel development that is going to throw investors for loops. And that has real world implications for people who have retirement accounts. It has real world implications for people who are putting their savings in mutual funds, that type of thing. There's a lot more uncertainty now, I think, than even you and I were talking about a couple months ago, last year, in these markets. And that's apart from even all of the debt considerations.
And Ed, let me just say one more thing before all the viewers don't want to listen to either one of us anymore. And that is, and I can't harp on this enough, and I don't mean to belittle, because I'm certain there are a small minority of who I'm about to address who don't fit what I'm about to describe, but I can't emphasize enough how critical it is that the average advisor in the United States has been in this practice 10 years or less. So at best, they might have partook in the 2008, which was, you know, wasn't horrific, but the lack of, and being it, you've heard me use this way to describe it, that we had all these young folks learn to drive on a one-way street. And remember, I'd always say, what happens when we get to that first traffic circle? I always bring up, I remember how I got to my first traffic circle. I was petrified. I didn't know what to do. Not only was traffic coming from this side, but it was coming from that side, too. And right. That's what I think is also adding to this year. And, of course, the original thing everybody tells everybody, and it worked for a lot of years, but I'll tell you in a moment why I don't think it worked, is, well, just hold on. It always turns. It always gets better. The market always returns. Yes, because we had, for lots of years, a printing press that was let go wild and it went insane, it gave an artificial lift. But that ability is gone. And we've had periods in the stock market, some as long as 30 years, before markets returned back to levels that they were once at, not counting the loss of purchase power during those periods. So if we go to where it's not in 3 or 6 months where things turn back and everybody's back to making money again, and before you know it, 12 months go by and people start to see a whole year where they actually didn't make money, here's what I also used to talk about where it comes into play now, Ed. Remember I've talked about that now there's more money in passive funds than there are in managed funds? Something I've spoken, I know, with you on your own show.
Right.
Why that's important is, right now, those funds are not actively managed. Managers are not buying or selling individual stocks within those funds. They're just buying stocks to trade against and match performances of indexes. Whereas in a managed account, the market go down, but the manager may say, no, these stocks that I own, I don't think they should be sold, and he ends up being right, and people don't lose as much, or they actually make money. That won't be the case. When the passive money decides it needs to get out, that manager has no choice but to sell. And then the selling begets selling, and then you have the machines kicking in and all the computers that trade on headlines and all that stuff. And that's what I said. As much as it was enjoyable on the way up, please don't forget, I tell everybody, that there's a possibility that the same at worst can happen to the downside. And most people just said, that's not going to happen, or I'm not going to prepare for that, or I don't want to hear that. You know, the thing I heard most through 2021 is this, Ed. Pete, I think you're right, but I hope you end up wrong. that was probably the most common way to describe when I sat with most people.
That was my reaction. I mean, you and I talked about that. I think you're right. In fact, I'm almost positive you're right. I just hope that you're wrong.
And you know, hope is not necessarily a great investment strategy.
I'll just put it that way.
Ed, at the beginning was an actual video, I guess you guys must listen to it, that I played to my clients and friends, because I was struggling this week that to have such enormous gains and be right on so many sides. But because that's come at the expense of what we're seeing live in Ukraine, and I think we're going to see it expanded and people suffering from food shortages and inabilities to pay, you know, the simplest things for gas and all that type of stuff, I'd give it all back. I mean that so sincerely. But it's here. And, you know, as my parish priest said when I spoke to him earlier this week, he said, listen, you were just saying what God placed in your heart and to be a voice. So people cannot say, well, at least I never heard anybody present that. They had the choice. You had your choice. And we live with our choices.
I think that's a great point. We're speaking with Peter Grandage from petergrandage.com, and I know a lot of people at Relevant Radio really appreciated that video. That's one of the reasons why they wanted to make sure it got played here. So it's sort of a thank you for producing that video, Peter. And you can see this at petergrandage.com. And we got a couple minutes left, and I want to just talk to you a little bit about inflation, and because you mentioned it, you just brought it up. And the Federal Reserve, and I believe it was Jerome Powell, was saying yesterday or the day before yesterday that they're looking at a maybe a quarter point increase in the interest rate. And Larry Summers was talking about this, and he said the real risk here is that the Federal Reserve is going to be too timid in trying to arrest inflation. Do you think that Summers is onto something here, and do you think that Powell is missing the mark, or is he just too constrained?
I think it's a combination of both, but I agree a lot with Summers, and that's because the Fed has become politicized. It is not the independent group that it might have once been, and we also know why last year, because so many of these guys were trading their own accounts and being long stocks. But I'll just say this. Your only matters now is what happens going forward. You can't live in the past and everything, and the market's no different. My biggest concern now is this. you could still own some stocks or stock groups that do well. So even if the market ends up going down further, say, you could still somehow make money in the stock market. That is a distinct possibility. I can tell you this. If inflation remains at 5, 6, 8, or 10, and I think it's at least somewhere at that level now, and is likely to stay there, you can't make money in bonds because of rates have to go up sooner or later, because whether the Fed wants to or not, because who wants to lend somebody out money at 1% when they're losing 6 or 7% of purchasing power? You're going to want an interest rate at least comparable to inflation. So if deflation is not, remember the word transitory, that's gone. Now I don't know what new wording they're going to come up, but if it's something that's here for the next couple or few years, you can't have 1% or 2% interest rates, no matter whether you want to or not. And that's where I think the big problems. And, of course, the lower or the more riskier bonds, which more the public tends to own, the corporate bonds and high-yield funds, if you still want to call those things that, they will be the ones where you – and it's – Drew was shocked last year when I said to him, I think bonds can lose double digits. And to be in this business – and to say bonds can lose money, that's because the Fed destroyed the fixed income market. There really isn't one anymore. But so the inflation, as bad as it is for stocks, it's, I think, 5 to 10 times worse for bonds. And that's where, remember this, and let me give you the last piece that I think people need to talk about, because I know retail people listening did this, because I saw it for several years. Because interest rates fell so low, people went into dividend-paying stocks in order to hopefully get a dividend that can keep their current lifestyle consistent, because they couldn't get that anymore in CDs or Ginnie Mae's or things of that nature. Okay, it's very, very important to people to understand, and I don't know if they fully understand it, because I still see it in my own retirement community here. I get this question all the time. Dividends are not certain. And if we're going to see a slowdown in economy, higher inflation, things tougher, a lot of corporations are not going to be able to maintain their current dividends. They're going to have to cut back. And I don't think people prepare for that. A statement I've heard so many times in my community is, hey, Pete, I don't care if my stock goes down 20%. I just hope they don't cut the dividend because I live off the dividend. Right. That's the unknown thing. That's the thing that's not yet being discussed in the airways, in the financial communities, and so forth and so on. But I would caution people who have taken a lot of risk on by taking on dividends, please understand those things are not certain. And one of the areas you're going to see companies cut back on first is the dividends that they pay.
Peter, I want to go to a caller really quickly before we let you go. Richard from Rancho Cucamonga, California, has a question for you. Richard, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, guys. Quick question for you, Peter. My dad is currently almost, he's cashing out all of his assets, and he's got a bunch of silver that he doesn't know if he should unload yet. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's a personal choice. For me, I personally stepped in the biggest I ever did this past fall into gold. Not as much silver, because it's not the monetary metal that some would like you to think. But, you know, there's going to be a correction in these things, but they've been in such a bear market or such on the low investment sentiment that very few people cared about it. They're likely to have a better chance of going further up. But here's the thing, and if I may just say this for everybody, the biggest complaint I heard in 38 years is you financial guys tell us when to buy, you never tell us when to sell. All you got to do is ask your dad, hey, Dad, if you didn't own it now, would you first buy it today? And if he struggles and questions or even says no, that's pretty well your answer, okay? And to count on what one person may think it's going to go up, another may think it goes sideways, if you can't first buy something today, that's the first clue that you may be what you have you shouldn't own anymore. And start with that and see how that feels after you say that to him.
Peter Granage, and by the way, Richard, thank you very much for your call, Richard, from Rancho Cucamonga, California. Peter Granage, Thank you so much for being with us. You can find out more about Peter's work at petergrandage.com, or you can read his book, Confessions of a Wall Street Whiz Kid, online, or you can order it there as well. You can also find him on Twitter, at Peter Grandage on Twitter. He's not on there too much anymore, but at least it's got the links to go to his website if you're on there. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio, your virtual parish.
It's 33 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of hotair.com, filling in for Drew today. Taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Hey, look, Cale Clark is coming up next, and Cale has got a great topic coming up. He's going to be talking about, and I just scrolled off my screen just as I said that, doggone it. He's going to be talking about how music leads us to God, and he's also going to continue talking about the Girl Scouts. So be sure to tune in Cale Clark on The Cale Clark Show at 5 p.m. Central Time, coming up right after this show concludes. So, yes, Cale Clark. And joining me now is my friend Deacon Stephen Gradenis from DecentFilms.com. He is a great film reviewer, has all sorts of great insight into movies, member of the New York Film Critics Circle, permanent deacon in the Archdiocese of Newark. You can read his latest work at Catholic World Report, and he's also written for the Catholic Register and Our Sunday Visitor, among others. And Deacon Stephen, great to have you back on.
Ed, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, you know, I always like kind of finishing up on a Friday talking about fun things, you know, especially the movies, right? And going to the cinema, if you have a cinema that is actually open nearby you, or whatever's on the stream right now, because there's all sorts of different options for people to access entertainment here as the weekend rolls around.
Yes, and sometimes the entertainment is, you mentioned fun. Sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's not so much fun. The two movies that I'm most interested in talking about here today, the one that opens today, The Batman from Matt Reeves, and then last week's Cyrano. I guess I would say Cyrano is fun. I'm not sure The Batman is fun, but that's not going to stop people from enjoying it.
You know, Deacon Stephen, I was just sitting around the other day, and I was thinking to myself while I was deep in contemplation that what I really need is another Batman story. What is this, the 900th version of Batman? And I think it's the third dystopian vision. Now, I have to say, I'm joking around, of course, because people reimagine things all the time. And you actually had a fun thing about Spider-Man No Way Home, right? Recently about that. And that's another thing that's gone through a few iterations, and they kind of used that in the latest Spider-Man movie, which I'm sure made it fun. I haven't seen it myself, but I'm sure made it fun. But
it was
I'm sorry,
fun.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it was so much fun. I have enjoyed all of the iterations of Spider-Man, but to see them all come together in this way, even if, I'm not saying it was a perfect movie or anything, but they brought in some of the emotional resonance, particularly around the Dr. Octopus character and his relationship with the first Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire. And, definitely fun. Not the masterpiece that Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was, but a lot of fun. So the new Batman movie, as you said, Ed, it's the latest in a large number of reboots of this character. And I don't think we're going to be seeing these different Batmans getting together anytime soon. Although it is very interesting to watch how the character has evolved over the decades, really, from along with the rest of popular culture and along really with the culture as a whole. And that's what I tried to address in this new piece that I've written about Batman and about the Batman and then other Batman iterations for Catholic World Report. Cape
right,
Crusaders
right.
and the Common take Crusaders in the common good.
I apologize, Zeke and Stephen Gray Donis. I read it was a great article about the Cape Crusaders and the common good, and I think I actually had more appreciation for the various different iterations of the Batman films after reading that. And of course, you get into Zorro and other other film platforms that use sort of the similar tropes, and. I mean, I thought it was really insightful, actually, how you sort of deconstructed the Christopher Nolan Batman and pointed out its philosophical weakness and something I hadn't considered in the Christopher Nolan series, which I thought was brilliant. I thought the whole series was brilliant. But there's actually a core philosophical weakness to it, and I hadn't noticed it until I read your article.
Well, thank you so much. I honestly believe Nolan didn't realize it either, because he didn't plan the Dark Knight trilogy as a trilogy. Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises were each conceived separately, and they each have their own thematic resonances. But it turns out that there is a common core to all three films. Nolan may not have planned it that way, but he did actually structure it that way. In each film, you have a villain who is pronouncing some kind of judgment on Gotham, on the people of Gotham, on its institutions. It's corrupt. It's selfish. These people will eat themselves, Heath Ledger's Joker says. Ra's al Ghul in the first film, played by Liam Neeson, says Gotham is irredeemably corrupt. Bane in the third film says you put these people in a crisis, they're going to clamber over each other. And in all three films, Batman is almost in the position of like Abraham, right? Negotiating with God over the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah. God isn't going to come and destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham says, well, there might be some good people here. Batman is saying there are good people in Gotham who only need to be a chance. They need opportunity. They need to be shown the way. And that's the argument that he makes to Ra's al Ghul in the first film. And the whole series is kind of like under the shadow of September 11. The September 11 attacks are thematically woven throughout these films. And by the end, I realized this is a series that never got its United 93 moment. There was never a moment where the people of Gotham finally rise up and show us who they are. Are the villains right? Is Batman right? I think Christopher Nolan just forgot to answer the question.
Well, it's interesting because I think he actually starts to answer it in The Dark Knight, because when the Joker, we're in the weeds here, of course, because Stephen Gray does, it's like two movie nerds talking, which is great. I love this stuff. But when the Joker gives the two bombs, right, the whole moment with the two different fairies that are in the river, and neither one of them will trigger the bombs, that I think actually does answer it somewhat. But you're right. After having had that moment, you would expect that the third film would really build on that, and that's the reason why Bruce Wayne can stay. Spoiler alert: the film's been out for a few years, so I'm just going to assume that if you haven't seen it, it's fine. It's the reason why Bruce Wayne can stage his own death and go off and live his best life without having to worry about being the Batman again. That would actually justify that, but you're right, and I realized that when I was reading your article about this, is that that moment was missing.
It really was, and it makes me wonder now, watching The Batman, the new film from Matt Reeves. This is the filmmaker behind the second and third movies in the recent Planet of the Apes trilogy, which I think are just wonderful films, and with a real moral and humane heart to them. He in this film, he gives us a Batman who is about 2 years into his crusade on crime. He's established a relationship with Commissioner Gordon, but he's not trusted by the rest of the police, who are all corrupt and in the pockets of big crime anyway. And this is really a movie about the corruption of institutions and the hopelessness of the city, and whether even methods as extreme as Batman's can make a difference, and what it is that the city really needs. In the end, this is a movie that knows that we need more than vengeance, that we need hope. But after 3 hours of almost unrelenting darkness, I was like, where is the hope? Well, and I don't know. Maybe because it's a trilogy, maybe Matt Reeves is planning on breaking up a little bit more hope in the second and third films. We'll have to wait and see.
So on its own, though, I mean, you're looking at this on its own, and this is the big openness this weekend. As all Batman movies are, hugely promoted. I think even more so than during the Tim Burton, and maybe even more so during the Christopher Nolan thing, is you've got DC and Warner that's competing now with Marvel. And so there's a tremendous competition going on here amongst, maybe not head-to-head, I don't know if Marvel's got anything out at the moment, but in terms of cultural draw, there's a tremendous competition here. So does this version of the Batman bring the goods that will allow, DC and Warner Brothers to put up a fight against Marvel?
The answer is, I think it's going to be a very divisive film. Almost in, at least in a similar way, or in a not entirely dissimilar way, as Todd Phillips' Joker film was a very divisive film. These are movies with a lot of darkness in them. They deal with the characters' very kind of unhealthy psychological journey. Batman is certainly, I would say the Batman mythos is more rigorously cross-examined in this film than in any other film so far. We're really looking at this character saying, what are you doing? Are you actually improving the situation? Are you making a difference? And he's asking himself these questions. And what I find in the end of the film is that there are questions about what we need, but so much hopelessness in the face of institutional corruption and broken promises of renewal. That's a big one in this film. And even the discovery, the kind of dethroning of revered father figures. And these are all themes I think Catholics will really resonate with. But nobody's going to come out of this movie feeling like they had a really good time. You might get catharsis from it. You might get something meaningful out of it. But I think it's really a film about what ails us more than any solutions to what ails us. And for people who are looking for escapism, people who are looking for fun, this is not going to be the film that's going to do that for you.
Yeah, and this is an interesting point. I want to come back to that point when we come back from break, and I also want to talk about Cyrano, which is opening up, and see if that addresses one of the point I'm going to make. Coming back on the other side of the break, we're speaking with Deacon Stephen Graydana from DecentFilms.com about what's coming up at the theaters this weekend, so stay tuned. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 48 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and talking with our good friend Deacon Stephen Graydanis from DecentFilms.com. He's a member of the New York Film Critics Circle and a permanent deacon in the Archdiocese of Newark. DecentFilms.com is where you can find his movie reviews and so much more. And we're just in the middle of talking about the lack of fun, I think, coming up this weekend, Deacon Stephen. And here's my question for you, just to wrap up the conversation about the Batman and, sort of that dark, dystopian type of film. Certainly when they were making this, maybe nobody really thought too much about this, but, they made it during the pandemic, and now you've got a war that's breaking out in Europe for the first time in at least 20 years, as Yugoslavia fell apart. That turned into a regional war in Europe as well. I mean, these are not cheery days, and normally, in times like that, you would go look for ways to distract yourself from misery rather than trying to find ways to sort of immerse yourself in it. And I mean, is this it's an odd time for this type of movie to come out. It strikes me that way.
And it will be interesting to see how that's reflected in the box office results. You know, obviously Batman is a super popular character, and I think the film's probably going to do well. But sometimes hard times send people looking for extreme experiences. You know, it can happen that a very intense and even grueling movie can have a cathartic effect by exposing you to something that at least takes your mind off of what else you're thinking about. You know, you might not be in the mood for something light and fluffy. Some people say that Disney's Fantasia flopped originally because Depression-era audiences were in no mood for whimsy. And so people who are suffering, sometimes a movie that makes you suffer in a different way, you know, at least it's a change.
Well, that's a good point. And again, it's everybody's got broad taste. You know, there's a broad taste in the marketplace. So, and there's already a built-in audience for, you know, DC comic book, you know, based movies, graphic novel based movies. And there's a very large and loyal fan base for that. So I'm going to guess that this thing's going to have a huge box office opening. I'm just kind of curious as to how much staying power it's going to have. But there's another movie opening up that would certainly interest me more. I don't know if I'm going to make it out to a cinema this weekend, but it would certainly interest me more, and when I get a chance to see it, I definitely want to watch it, is the Peter Dinklage starring Cyrano. Cyrano with, instead of having someone with a large nose, which is, of course, if you watch the Jose Ferrer version, or if you watched, you know, Steve Martin's comic version in Roxanne, you know, the big prosthetic nose. Instead, Peter Dinklage, who is a little person, is going to adopt that as his as the physical impediment that sort of sets up Cyrano. And Dinklage is an amazing actor. People will have recognized him from, you know, Game of Thrones. He has a critical role, not a major role, but a critical role in the movie Elf, if you've ever seen Elf, where he's Dinklage is absolutely hilarious in that mouth. But he's extremely, he's got a wide range of talents. He can do comedy, he can do drama, he can do all sorts of different things. How does he do in Cyrano? I just think that it's going to be an amazing experience watching him take on that role.
You know, I like Cyrano a lot, and it's so fascinating to me the kind of accidents that helped make the movie come into play. The playwright and screenwriter Erica Schmidt had the idea of writing a Cyrano without the nose, just letting it be up to the audience's interpretation what Cyrano's issue was. And she happens to be married to Dinklage. She didn't envision him in the role, but when he started to read it, then she realized it's him. Then the actress that they cast as Roxanne, the lyricists are Matt Berenger and Karen Becker. Kelly Bennett played the role of Roxanne opposite from Cyrano on the stage. And she happens to be married to the filmmaker Joe Wright, who did Anna Karenina, among other things, Pride and Prejudice. And when he saw the play, he wanted to make the film. So it's a musical. They shot it in Sicily. They used Renaissance era architecture and the amazing landscape, wonderful costumes. And I think there's something really powerful about having Dinklage in this role. He is an actor who has just a real a purity of emotion, but also a real sense of guardedness, of kind of a protective use of wit and humor. And I think it works really well in the part.
He also has almost in all of his work, this sort of heightened sense of dignity. And in some cases, it expresses his arrogance, which I just find to be really the quintessential Cyrano, right? I mean, you talk about Jose Ferrer's, you know, brilliant performance in his film version of Cyrano de Bergerac, or even Steve Martin, right, as a comic version of Cyrano. It's, you know, C.D. Bales in Roxanne against, you know, Daryl Hannah. Dinklage, to me, it's always been a part of his on-screen persona, whether it's on film or on television. And so I just think that, you know, when I first heard about this concept, I thought, man, that's just almost like a perfect marriage of actor to role.
And what's interesting about the way that the material came together with the songs, the lyrics, and the music by members of the indie rock band The National is how this kind of theological theme suddenly arises in the material. There's a little bit of it in the original play, but what emerges from the very beginning in Cyrano is anger at God, disappointment with God at his physical stature, at his deficiency compared to everyone else, at least in his inability to try to woo Roxanne because he feels unworthy of her. He's angry at God, and that comes out in this kind of almost Hamiltonian rap battle that he does against himself while dueling an opponent. Later in the film, in the battle scene where as we transition from the second act into the third act, we get a very different theological note as the soldiers are writing letters home to the people back at home and wanting to assure them that they died at peace. The theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity are woven into these lyrics. And there's this idea of heaven being present at the moment of your death. Heaven is wherever I fall is the recurring line. And then in the end, we get themes that come a little bit more from the original play. As Cyrano, in the very end of the play, he has a conversation with a nun who he jokes is trying to convert him. And she says she's not. And then he says, tonight I'm going to give you permission to pray for me. And her response is, I haven't waited for your permission. But that little moment of openness to God at a crucial moment in Cyrano's life, I don't want to give away the ending if you haven't seen it. I found that woven throughout the film, that kind of theological angst ending in some kind of peace or openness to reconciliation with God. I found it very moving.
Well, and I think that's sort of our journey in Lent too, to some extent, right? Is that we're trying to reconcile ourselves to God while trying to figure out how to get past the sin and get past our own arrogance. Which, again, you know, this is an element that you see in the original Cyrano too. But I mean, I think that this makes it a really great Lent movie, right?
That's a very interesting way of putting it. You know, we tell ourselves that we were beginning Lent with, you know, all kinds of desires for holiness and everything. But as St. Augustine points out, sometimes, you know, you find you're praying, Lord, give me virtue. But some part of you is saying, but not yet. And that really is part of what Lent is about, is getting to the root of what in us still resists God. Yeah, it is definitely resonant with nature.
Well, that's opening this weekend, Cyrano, with starring Peter Dinklage, and you can find out more about what Deacon Stephen Gray Dennis thinks about that at decentfilms.com, decentfilms.com. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the year in reviews. He's got a piece up about that. You can check that out as well. And The Tragedy of Macbeth, I want to get you back on sometime to talk about The Tragedy of Macbeth. I haven't seen it yet, but, man, it looks great.
Oh, it was one of my top 10 films of last year, and you tell me what. You tell me when you want to talk about it, and I'll be there, Ed.
That sounds great. Deacon Stephen Gray Dennis, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. Stay tuned for Cale Clark.